For 3 months in 1965, and ending in October of that year, a young girl would endure horrific neglect, abuse, and torture at the hands of her caregiver and others. This is the extreme true crime story of the murder of Sylvia Likens.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes.
It was fun.
The torture and murder of Sylvia Likens is largely regarded by Indiana citizens as one of the worst crimes ever committed in their state, and has been described by a senior investigator as the most sadistic case he had ever investigated in the 35 years he served with the Indianapolis Police. Sylvia Marie Likens, born January 3, 1949, was the third of five children born to carnival workers Lester Likens and his wife, Elizabeth Frances. She was born between two sets of fraternal twins, Diana and Daniel, 2 years older, and Jenny and Benny, 1 year younger. Jenny Likens had suffered from polio, causing one of her legs to be weaker than the other. She was afflicted with a notable limp and had to wear a steel brace on one leg to assist her. Lester and Elizabeth's marriage was unstable. They often sold candy, beer, and soda at carnival stands around Indiana throughout the summer, moving frequently and regularly experiencing severe financial difficulties. The Likens boys regularly traveled with their parents to help out, but because of their concern for their younger daughter's safety and education, they didn't particularly want Sylvia and Jenny traveling with them in this employment. Both girls frequently lived with relatives, often their grandmother, so that their schoolwork wouldn't suffer while their parents and brothers traveled with the carnival. In her teenage years, Sylvia would earn spending money by babysitting, running errands, or performing ironing chores for friends and neighbors, often giving her mother part of her earnings. She had been described as friendly, confident, and a lively girl with long, wavy, light brown hair, and was known as Cookie to her friends. Often high-spirited, Sylvia always kept her mouth closed when smiling, due to having lost a front tooth in a collision with one of her brothers. She also had a fondness for music, mostly the Beatles, and was notably protective of her more timid younger sister, Jenny. On several occasions, the two sisters would visit a skating rink, where Sylvia would lead Jenny around the rink by hand as they skated. By June 1965, Sylvia and Jenny lived with their parents in Indianapolis. On July 3rd, their mother was arrested and jailed for shoplifting. Shortly after, Lester arranged for his daughters to board with Gertrude Banaszewski, the mother of two girls that Sylvia and Jenny had recently met while in high school, Paula and Stephanie Banaszewski. At this time of the boarding agreement, Gertrude assured Lester that she would care for his daughters until his return. Gertrude Banaszewski, born September 19, 1928, was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. Banaszewski was the third of six children, and her family was working class. On October 5, 1939, Banaszewski saw her 50-year-old father die from a heart attack. 6 years later, she dropped out of high school at age 16 to marry 18-year-old John Banaszewski, and to whom she gave birth to four children with. Although John Banaszewski had a volatile temper and occasionally beat his wife, the two would remain together for 10 years prior to their first divorce. Following the divorce, Gertrude married a man, Edward Guthrie. This marriage lasted just 3 months before the couple divorced. Shortly after this, Banaszewski remarried her first husband, giving him two more children. The couple divorced again in 1963. Just a few weeks after her third divorce, Gertrude began a relationship with a 22-year-old man named Dennis Lee Wright, who also physically abused her. She had one child with Wright, Dennis Lee Wright Jr. Shortly after the birth of his son, Wright abandoned Banaszewski. By 1965, Gertrude lived alone with her seven children, Paula, Stephanie, John, Marie, Shirley, James, and Dennis Lee Wright. Although 36 years old and 5 feet 6 inches tall, she only weighed 100 pounds and was described as being haggard and underweight. A chain smoker suffering from depression due to the stress of 3 failed marriages and a recent miscarriage, in addition to the sporadic checks she received from her first husband, Gertrude occasionally performed odd jobs for neighbors and acquaintances, such as sewing or cleaning, in order to earn money. Shortly after the 4th of July holiday, Jenny and Sylvia moved into the Banaszewski household so that their father and later mother could travel with the carnival, with the understanding that Gertrude would receive weekly fees of $20 to care for their daughters until they returned to collect Sylvia and Jenny in November of that year. In the first few weeks Sylvia and Jenny lived at Banaszewski House, there was very little discipline or abuse. Sylvia regularly sang along with pop records with Stephanie, and she willingly participated in housework and chores at the Banaszewski residence. Both girls also regularly attended Sunday school with the Banaszewski children. The abuse. Although Lester had agreed to pay Gertrude $20 a week in exchange for the care of his daughters, these weekly payments slowly failed to arrive exactly upon the prearranged dates, sometimes showing up a few days late. Because of this, Gertrude began venting her frustration on the sisters by beating their bare buttocks with belts and paddles, making statements such as, "Well, I took care of you two little bitches for a week for nothing." On one occasion, in late August, both girls were beaten approximately 15 times on the back with the paddle. After Paula had accused the sisters of eating too much food at a church supper the children had attended. By August 1965, Gertrude had begun to focus her abuse almost exclusively on Sylvia, with her primary motivation most likely being jealousy of Sylvia's looks. This initial abuse included subjecting Sylvia to beatings and being refused food, which would gradually lead to Sylvia eating leftovers or spoiled food out of garbage cans. On one occasion, Sylvia was accused of stealing candy that she had actually purchased. On another, Sylvia was subjected to humiliation when she claimed to have a boyfriend in Long Beach with whom she had met when her family lived in California. In response to hearing this, Gertrude asked her if she had ever done anything to a boy. Sylvia answered her that she guessed so, unsure of her meaning, and offered that she had gone skating with the boys there and once went to a park on the beach with them and Jenny. Continuing the conversation with Stephanie and Jenny, Sylvia mentioned that she had once laid under the covers with her boyfriend. When Gertrude heard this, she asked, "Why did you do that, Sylvia?" Sylvia replied, "I don't know," and shrugged. Some days later, Gertrude returned to the subject with Sylvia, telling her that, "You're certainly getting big in the stomach, Sylvia. It looks like you're going to have a baby." Sylvia thought Gertrude was kidding and said, "Yeah, it sure is getting big. I'm just going to have to go on a diet." However, Gertrude then told her and the other girls in the house that whenever they did something with a boy, they would be sure to have a baby. She then kicked Sylvia in the genitals. Paula now joined in, knocking Sylvia off the chair onto the kitchen floor, and yelled, "You ain't fit to sit in a chair." On another occasion, as the family ate supper, Gertrude, Paula, and a neighborhood boy named Randy Gordon Lepper force-fed Sylvia a hot dog overloaded with toppings, including mustard, ketchup, and spices. Sylvia vomited as a result and was later forced to eat what she had thrown up. Sylvia's only act of retaliation was spreading a rumor at high school that Stephanie and Paula were prostitutes. She did this because she was upset with the household singling her out for similar accusations. While at school, Stephanie was jokingly hit on by a boy who told her that Sylvia had started the rumor about her. Upon returning home that day, Stephanie asked Sylvia about the rumor, and Sylvia admitted to starting it. Stephanie punched her in response, and Sylvia apologized to her in tears, and Stephanie then also began to cry. However, when Stephanie's boyfriend, 15-year-old Coy Hubbard, heard about the rumor, he brutally attacked Sylvia, slapping her, banging her head against the wall, and flipping her backwards onto the floor. When Gertrude found out, she used a paddle to beat Sylvia. On another occasion, Paula beat Sylvia around the face with such force that she broke her own wrist while focusing the blows upon Sylvia's teeth and eyes. Later, Paula would use the cast on her wrist to further beat Sylvia. Gertrude often falsely accused Sylvia of promiscuity and of engaging in prostitution, delivering misogynistic sermons to Sylvia regarding the filthiness of prostitution and of women in general. Gertrude would later occasionally force Jenny to hit her own sister, beating Jenny if she did not listen. Coy Hubbard and several of his friends often visited the Banaszewski house to both physically and verbally torment Sylvia, often working with the Banaszewski children and Gertrude herself. With the encouragement of Gertrude, these neighborhood children would often beat Sylvia, sometimes using her as a practice dummy in violent karate lessons, cutting her body, burning her skin with lit cigarettes in excess of 100 times, and severely injuring her genitals. To entertain Gertrude and her teenage accomplices, Sylvia was forced at one point to strip naked in the family room and insert an empty Coke bottle into her own vagina in their presence. With Gertrude saying to all that were there that this act of humiliation for Sylvia was to prove to Jenny what kind of girl she was. Gertrude eventually forbade Sylvia from attending school after she confessed to having stolen a gym suit from the school, after Gertrude had refused to buy one for her. For this act of theft, Gertrude whipped Sylvia with a police belt. Gertrude then switched the conversation to the evils of premarital sex before repeatedly kicking Sylvia in the genitals as Stephanie uncharacteristically came to Sylvia's defense, shouting, "She didn't do anything." Gertrude then burned Sylvia's fingertips with matches before further whipping her. A few days later, Gertrude whipped Jenny with the police belt after she supposedly stole a single tennis shoe from the school to wear on her strong foot. The Lycan sisters were scared of telling either family or adults at their school of the increasing incidents of abuse and neglect they were enduring because both were afraid that doing so would only worsen the issues. Jenny in particular struggled against the urge to notify family members because she had been threatened by Gertrude that she herself would be abused and tortured the same as her sister was. Jenny was also subjected to bullying by girls in her neighborhood, in addition to being ridiculed or beaten whenever she suggested Sylvia's situation. In July and August, Lester and Elizabeth Lykins would sometimes return to Indianapolis to visit their daughters, whenever their travel schedule allowed them to. The last occasion Lester and Elizabeth visited their daughters was in late August. At this time, neither girl showed any signs of distress about their abuse to their parents, likely because both were in the presence of Gertrude and her children. Almost immediately after Lester and Elizabeth had left the Banaszewski house on their final visit, Gertrude turned to face Sylvia and said, "What are you going to do now that they're gone?" On one occasion in September, the girls ran into their older sister, Diana Shoemaker, at a nearby park. Both Jenny and Sylvia informed Diana about the abuse they were enduring at the hands of their caregiver on this occasion, adding that Sylvia was being specifically targeted for the abuse, almost always for things she had neither done or said. Neither sister mentioned the actual address where they lived initially, and Diana believed her sisters must be exaggerating their claims regarding the intensity of their mistreatment. Several weeks before this occasion, Sylvia and Jenny had encountered Diana in the same park while in the company of 11-year-old Marie Banaszewski, and Sylvia had been given a sandwich to eat when she told her sister she was hungry. Sylvia remained silent about the matter, but Marie revealed this fact to her family in late September. In response, Gertrude accused Sylvia of being gluttonous before she and Paula choked and beat her. The pair then subjected Sylvia to a scalding bath to cleanse her of her sin, with Gertrude grabbing Sylvia's hair and repeatedly banging her head against the bath to revive her when she fainted. Shortly after this happened, the father of a neighborhood boy named Michael John Monroe phoned the high school to anonymously report that a girl with open sores across her entire body was living in the Banaszewski house. Sylvia had not attended school for several days. A school nurse visited the house to investigate these claims. Gertrude claimed to the nurse that Sylvia had run away from her home the previous week and that she was unaware of her actual whereabouts, adding that she was out of control and that her open sores were a result of Sylvia's refusal to maintain decent personal hygiene. Gertrude also claimed that Sylvia was a bad influence on both her own children and her sister. The school made no further investigations into Sylvia's welfare. On two separate occasions, neighbors visually witnessed the abuse of the girls but failed to report anything to the proper authorities. Sometime in October, Diana Shoemaker discovered that her sisters were living in the Banaszewski house. She visited the house in an attempt to initiate regular contact. Gertrude refused Diana entrance to her property, saying that she had gotten permission from their parents not to allow either girl to see her. She then ordered Diana to leave. Two or so weeks later, Diana ran into Jenny by chance and asked about Sylvia's welfare. She was brusquely informed, "I can't tell you or I'll get into trouble too." Escalation. Due to the increase in frequency and the brutality of the torture and mistreatment she was subjected to, Sylvia gradually became incontinent. She was denied any access to the bathroom, being forced to wet herself. As a form of punishment to her incontinence, in October, Gertrude simply threw Sylvia into the basement and tied her up. Here, Sylvia was often kept naked, rarely fed, and frequently deprived of water. Occasionally, she would be tied to the railing of basement stairs in a torture rack fashion, with her feet just barely touching the ground. In the weeks leading up to locking Sylvia in the basement, Gertrude had made a habit of abusing and tormenting Sylvia, a pastime. Gertrude would make claims to the children in the house that either she or one of them had been on the receiving end of insults from Sylvia, in the hope that this would get them to belittle or attack Sylvia. Once, Gertrude even held a knife aloft and challenged Sylvia to fight me back, to which Sylvia replied she didn't know how to fight. The tortures and torment were occasionally put on hold by the Banaszewskis to watch their favorite television shows. Neighborhood children were also occasionally charged 5 cents apiece to see the display of Sylvia's body and to humiliate, beat, scald, burn, and ultimately mutilate her. Throughout the period of Sylvia's captivity in the basement, Gertrude frequently, with the help of her children and friends, restrained Sylvia before placing her in a bathtub filled with boiling water, before proceeding to rub salt into her wounds. In order to quiet Sylvia's screams for mercy, her tormentors would regularly place a gag in her mouth as they tortured her. On one occasion, Gertrude and her 12-year-old son, John Jr., rubbed a fully used diaper from Gertrude's 1-year-old son into Sylvia's mouth, before giving her a cup half-filled with water and saying the water was all she would receive for the remainder of the day. On October 22nd, John Banaszewski Jr. gave Sylvia a bowl of soup but only allowed her to eat with her fingers, and then quickly took away the bowl when Sylvia, who was at this stage suffering from extreme malnourishment, tried to eat the food. Gertrude eventually allowed Sylvia to sleep upstairs on the condition that she did not wet herself. That night, Sylvia very quietly asked Jenny to secretly give her a glass of water before falling asleep. The next morning, Gertrude had discovered that Sylvia had wet herself. As a punishment, Sylvia was forced to masturbate with an empty Coke bottle in front of the other children before Gertrude forced her back into the basement. Shortly after the Coke bottle incident, Gertrude shouted for Sylvia to return to the kitchen and ordered her to strip naked before shouting at her, "You have branded my daughters, now I am going to brand you." She began carving the words, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," onto Sylvia's stomach with a heated needle. When Gertrude was unable to finish the job, she instructed one of the neighborhood children, 14-year-old Richard Hobbs, to finish burning the words into Sylvia's flesh as she took Jenny to a local grocery store. In what Hobbs would later insist were short, light etchings, he continued to brand the text into Sylvia's abdomen as she clenched her teeth and moaned. Both Hobbs and 10-year-old Shirley Banaszewski then took Sylvia back to the basement, where each proceeded to use an anchor bolt in an attempt to burn the letter S beneath Sylvia's left breast. Although they burned one section of the loop backwards, and this deep burn scar would resemble the number 3, Gertrude would later taunt Sylvia by claiming she would never be able to marry due to the words carved on her stomach, asking Sylvia, "What are you going to do now? You can't get married now. What are you going to do?" Through tears, Sylvia replied, "I guess there's nothing I can do." She was then carried back to the basement by Coy Hubbard. Later that day, Sylvia was forced to display the carving to the neighborhood kids, with Gertrude claiming she had received the markings at a sex party. That night, Sylvia reportedly confided to her sister, "Jenny, I know you don't want me to die, but I know I'm going to die. I can tell it." The following day, Gertrude woke Sylvia, then forced her to write a letter as she dictated the contents, which were intended to trick her parents into thinking their daughter had run away from the Banaszewski house. The content of this letter was intended to frame a group of local boys for extensively abusing and mutilating Sylvia after she had initially agreed to engage in sexual relations with them, before they inflicted the extreme abuse and torture upon her body. After Sylvia had written this letter, Gertrude finished formulating her plan to have John Jr. and Jenny blindfold Sylvia, then take her to a nearby wooded area known as Jimmy's Forest, and simply leave her to die within the woods. After she had finished writing the letter, Sylvia was then again tied to the stair railing and offered crackers to eat, although she refused them, saying, "Give it to the dog, I don't want it." In response, Gertrude forced the crackers into Sylvia's mouth before she and John beat her, particularly in the stomach area. October 25th and 26th. On October 25th, Sylvia tried to escape from the basement after overhearing a conversation between Gertrude and John Banaszewski Jr. pertaining to the family's plan to simply abandon her to die. She tried to flee to the front door, but because of her extensive injuries and overall weakness, Gertrude caught her before she could escape the property, and Sylvia was given toast to eat, but was unable to eat the food because of her extreme dehydration. Gertrude forced the toast into her mouth before repeatedly hitting her in the face with a curtain rod until parts of the rod were bent into right angles. Coy Hubbard then took the curtain rod from Gertrude and struck Sylvia one more time, knocking her unconscious. Gertrude then dragged Sylvia into the basement. That evening, Sylvia desperately tried to alert neighbors by screaming for help and hitting the walls of the basement with a small shovel. One immediate neighbor of the Banaszewskis would later tell police that she heard the desperate cries and that she had identified the source as coming from the basement next door. But then the noise had suddenly stopped at approximately 3 a.m., she decided not to inform the police about the disturbance. The death of Sylvia Likens. By the morning of October 26th, Sylvia was unable to either speak clearly or to correctly control the movement of her arms and legs. Gertrude did move Sylvia into the kitchen and, having leaned her back against the wall, attempted to feed her a donut and a glass of milk. Although she threw Sylvia to the ground in anger, when Sylvia was unable to correctly move the glass of water to her lips, she was then put back in the basement. Shortly after this, Sylvia became delirious, repeatedly moaning and mumbling. When Paula asked her to recite the alphabet, Sylvia was unable to say anything beyond the first 4 letters or to raise herself off the ground. In response, Paula threatened to stand her up or she would inflict a long jump upon her. Gertrude then ordered Sylvia, who had defecated, to clean herself. That afternoon, several of Sylvia's other tormentors gathered in the basement. Sylvia jerked her arms in an apparent attempt to point to the faces of the people she could recognize, making statements such as, "You're Ricky," and "You're Gertie," before Gertrude shouted, "Shut up, you know who I am." Minutes later, Sylvia unsuccessfully attempted to bite into a rotten pear she had been given to eat, saying that she could feel the looseness in her teeth. Hearing this, Jenny told her, "Don't you remember, Sylvia? Your front tooth was knocked out when you were 7. Jenny then left Sylvia in the basement to go do gardening chores for the neighbors in hopes of earning spending money. In an attempt to wash Sylvia, John Banaszewski sprayed her, while laughing, with a garden hose, brought to the house that afternoon by Randy Lepper at Gertrude's request. Sylvia again desperately attempted to escape the basement, but collapsed before she could reach the stairs. In response to this effort, Gertrude stamped upon Sylvia's head before standing and staring at her for several minutes. Stephanie then decided to give Sylvia a warm soapy bath, although Sylvia stopped breathing before she could be carried out of the basement. She was 16 years old. When Stephanie realized that she was not breathing, she attempted to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as Gertrude repeatedly shouted her belief to the children and teenagers present in her house that Sylvia was simply faking her death. Shortly after 5:30 p.m., Richard Hobbs returned to the Banaszewski house and immediately went to the basement. He slipped on the wet basement stairs and fell to the floor of the basement to be confronted with the sight of Stephanie crying and cuddling Sylvia's emaciated and cut up body. The arrests. When Gertrude finally accepted that efforts made to revive Sylvia by bathing her and her own efforts of twice hitting Sylvia's face with a book to revive her were unsuccessful, she told Richard to call the police from a nearby payphone. When the police arrived at approximately 6:30 p.m., Gertrude led the officers to Sylvia's emaciated, beat, and mutilated body, laying upon a soiled mattress in one of the bedrooms. Before giving them the letter she had forced Sylvia to previously write to her dictation, also saying she had been doctoring the child for an hour or more prior to her death, saying she had applied rubbing alcohol to Sylvia's wounds in a futile attempt at first aid before she had passed away. She added that Sylvia had earlier run away from home with several teenage boys before returning to her house earlier that afternoon, bare-breasted and clutching the note. Holding a Bible, Paula Banaszewski having said to all present in the house that Sylvia's death was meant to happen, then glanced in Jenny's direction and calmly stated, "If you want to live with us, Jenny, we will treat you like our own sister." As previously instructed by Gertrude, Jenny Likens told the rehearsed version of the events leading to Sylvia's death shortly after 5:30 p.m. that afternoon to the police, before whispering to the officers, "You get me out of here, and I will tell you everything." The formal statement provided by Jenny prompted officers to arrest Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, and John Banaszewski Jr. on suspicion of Sylvia's murder within hours of the discovery of her body. The same day, Coy Hubbard and Richard Hobbs were also arrested and charged with the same offenses. The three oldest Banaszewski children, plus Coy, were placed in the custody of a nearby juvenile detention center. The younger Banaszewski children and Richard Hobbs were detained at a children's guardian home. All were held without bail pending trial. At first, Gertrude denied any involvement in Sylvia's death, although by October 27th, she had confessed to having known the kids, particularly her daughter, Paula, and Coy Hubbard, had physically and emotionally abused Sylvia. Gertrude also admitted to having forced the girl to sleep in the basement on approximately 3 occasions when she had wet the bed. She became difficult when one officer stated the likely reasons Sylvia had become incontinent were to her mental distress and injury to her kidneys. 5 other children from the neighborhood who had also participated in Sylvia's abuse, Michael Monroe, Randy Lepper, Darlene McGuire, Judy Duke, and Anna Sisko, had also been arrested by October 29th. All were charged with causing injury to a person, and each was eventually released into the custody of their parents under subpoena to appear as witnesses at the upcoming trial. The autopsy. The autopsy of Sylvia's body revealed that she had suffered over 150 separate wounds across her body, in addition to being extremely emaciated at the time of her death. The wounds themselves varied in location and severity and the actual stage of healing. Her injuries included burns, severe bruising, and extensive muscle and nerve damage. Her vaginal cavity was almost swollen shut, although an examination of the canal determined that her hymen was still intact. The autopsy also discredited Gertrude's claims that Sylvia had been 3 months pregnant and a prostitute. In addition to those injuries, all of Sylvia's fingernails were broken backwards, and most of the external layers of skin on her face, breasts, neck, and right knee had peeled or receded. In the last minutes before her death, Sylvia had apparently bitten through her lips, partially severing sections of them from her face. The official cause of Sylvia's death was listed by coroner Dr. Arthur Kebble as subdural hematoma due to her receiving a severe blow to her right temple. Both the shock she had suffered due to the severe and prolonged torture inflicted to her skin and muscle tissues, plus the severe malnutrition, were listed as contributing factors to her death. Rigor mortis had fully set in at the time of the discovery of the body, indicating Sylvia may have been dead for up to 8 hours before she was found. Although Dr. Kebble did note Sylvia had been recently bathed, possibly after death, and that this could have sped up the loss of body temperature and therefore sped up the onset of rigor mortis. The funeral. The funeral service for Sylvia was conducted at the Russell and Hitch Funeral Home on the afternoon of October 29th. The service was officiated by the Reverend Lewis Gibson, with more than 100 mourners in attendance. Sylvia's gray casket remained open throughout the ceremony, with the portrait of her taken prior to July 65 decorating her coffin. In his eulogy, the Reverend stated, "We all have our time, but we won't suffer like our little sister suffered during the last days of her life." The Reverend then walked towards Sylvia's casket before adding, "She has gone to eternity." Following this service, Sylvia's casket was placed by pallbearers in a hearse and driven to Oak Hill Cemetery to be buried. This hearse was one of a 14-vehicle procession to drive to the cemetery for her burial. Sylvia's headstone is inscribed with the words, "Our darling daughter." Indictments. On December 30th, 1965, the Marion County Grand Jury returned first-degree murder indictments against Gertrude and two of her three oldest children, Paula and John Banaszewski Jr. Also indicted were Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard. All were charged with having repeatedly struck, beaten, kicked, and otherwise inflicted a multitude of fatal injuries to Sylvia Likens with premeditated intent. 3 weeks before the filing of the indictments against the five defendants, Stephanie Banaszewski was released from custody after her attorney successfully argued the state had insufficient evidence to link her to the finality or fatal injuries of Sylvia. Stephanie waived her immunity from potential prosecution while agreeing to testify against her family and any others charged with abusing and murdering Sylvia. At a pretrial hearing held on March 16, 1966, several psychiatrists testified that all three Banaszewski defendants, Gertrude, Paula, and John Jr., were mentally competent to stand trial. The trial of Gertrude, her children, Paula and John, Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard, began on April 18, 1966. All were tried together before Judge Rabb at Indianapolis's City County Building. Initial jury selection began on this date and continued for several days. The prosecution announced their intention to seek the death penalty for all five defendants. They also argued before Judge Rabb that the defendants should be tried together as they were ultimately charged with acting together in their collective crimes against Sylvia, and that as such, if each were tried separately, neither judge nor jury could hear testimony relating to a total picture of the accumulation of offenses committed. Testimony. One of the first witnesses to testify for the prosecution was Deputy Coroner Charles Ellis, who testified to the intense pain Sylvia had suffered, saying that her fingernails were broken backwards, numerous deep cuts and punctures covered much of her body, and that her lips were essentially in shreds due to her having repeatedly bitten and chewed on them. Ellis also testified that Sylvia had been in severe state of shock for between 2 and 3 days prior to her death, and that she may have been in too far a state of shock to offer any resistance to any form of treatment in her final hours, although he stressed that aside from the extensive swelling around her genitalia, Sylvia's body had no evidence of sexual molestation. On May 2nd and 3rd, Jenny Likens testified against all 5 defendants, saying that each had repeatedly and extensively both physically and emotionally abused her sister, adding that Sylvia had done nothing to provoke the beatings and that there had been no truth in the rumors that she had been accused of spreading or the slurs each had made against Sylvia's character. During her testimony, Jenny said the abuse her sister and to a much lesser degree herself endured began roughly 2 weeks after they had begun to live in the Banaszewski house, and that as the abuse her sister was forced to endure escalated, Sylvia had sometimes been unable to produce tears due to her severe state of dehydration. Jenny burst into tears as she remembered how, just days before Sylvia died, she had said to her, "Jenny, I know you don't want me to die, but I am going to die. I can tell it." Parts of Jenny's testimony were later corroborated by Randy Lepper, who said that he had once witnessed Sylvia crying, but that she didn't seem to have any tears. Lepper then visibly smirked as he confessed to having beaten Sylvia on anywhere between 10 and 40 separate occasions. On May 10th, Roy Julian, a Baptist minister, testified to having known a teenage girl was being abused in the Banaszewski house, although he had failed to report this information to police because he had been told by Gertrude that Sylvia had made many advances to men for money. He had believed the girl was being punished for soliciting. The same day, 13-year-old Judy Duke also testified, admitted to having seen Sylvia once endure salt being rubbed into her sores on her legs until she screamed. Duke also testified to one occasion where she had witnessed 10-year-old Shirley Banaszewski rip open Sylvia's blouse, at which Richard Hobbs had made the nonchalant remark, "Everybody's having fun with Sylvia." The following day, Gertrude testified in her own defense. She denied any responsibility for Sylvia's prolonged abuse, torture, and ultimate death, claiming her children and other children from the neighborhood must have committed the acts in her home, which she described as being such a madhouse. She also added that she had been too preoccupied by her own ill health and depression to control her children. In response to questioning relating to whether she had physically abused the Lycan sisters, Gertrude claimed that although she had started to spank Sylvia on one occasion, she was emotionally unable to finish doing and had not hit her on any further occasions. She denied any knowledge of Sylvia having endured any beating, scalding, branding, or burning in her own home. 2 days later, Richard Hobbs testified in his own defense, describing how Gertrude had called Sylvia to the kitchen on October 23rd and stated to her, "You have branded my children, so now I'm going to brand you." Hobbs testified Gertrude had begun etching the insult into Sylvia's abdomen before asking him to finish. Although Hobbs testified this act of branding had brought blood to the surface of Sylvia's flesh and that she had begged him to stop, he remained steadfast that the section of branding he had inflicted had been light. Hobbs also testified that he had initially believed Sylvia would not be at the Banaszewski house on October 26, as Gertrude had informed him she intended to get rid of Sylvia the prior day. When Marie Banaszewski was called to stand as a witness for the defense, she broke down and admitted that she had heated the needle which Hobbs had used to brand Sylvia's stomach. Marie also testified at her mother's indifference to Sylvia's clear distress with regards to the physical and mental abuse she had continually suffered with her mother's full knowledge, saying that on one occasion, Gertrude had simply sat in a chair and crocheted as she watched a neighborhood girl named Anna Sisko attack Sylvia. Marie added that although all five defendants had repeatedly physically and mentally tormented Sylvia, she had most often witnessed her mother and sister committing these acts. Before her mother had forced her to live in the basement where the abuse had further continued, and she had ultimately died. Another witness to testify on behalf of the prosecution was Grace Sargent. She said how she had sat near Paula on a bus and had heard her openly bragging about breaking her own wrist due to the severity of the beating that she had inflicted to Sylvia's face on August 1st. Sargent testified Paula had finished her bragging by saying, "I tried to kill her." On May 16th, a court-appointed doctor named Dwight Schuster testified on behalf of the prosecution. When questioned about the exhaustive interviews and assessments he had conducted with Gertrude, she had been evasive and uncooperative. Dr. Schuster testified as to his belief that Gertrude was sane and fully in control of her actions, adding that she had been sane in October 1965 and remained sane to this day. Dr. Schuster was subjected to over 2 hours of intense cross-examination by Gertrude's lawyer, although he remained steadfast that Gertrude was and had not ever been psychotic. Closing arguments. Deputy Prosecutor Marjorie Wesner delivered the state's closing argument before the jury on behalf of the prosecution. As each defendant, except Richard Hobbs, whose head dropped into his lap, remained emotionless, Wesner recounted the continuous torment Sylvia had endured before her death, emphasizing that at no point had she either provoked any of the defendants or received any medical care beyond occasionally having margarine rubbed into scalding sections of her face and body. Referencing specific forms of abuse and neglect at the defendants' hands and their collective failure to either help Sylvia or to stop each other from mistreating her, Wesner described Sylvia's abuse as stomach-wrenching and compared her treatment at the hands of all five defendants as being the equivalent in severity to that committed against prisoners in Nazi concentration camps. In reference to the premeditated nature of Sylvia's death, Wesner directed the jury's attention to the notes Gertrude had forced her to write on October 24th, saying that Gertrude knew that she was going to hold these notes until she and the rest of the defendants had completed the murder of Sylvia. Holding a portrait of Sylvia taken before July 1965, Wesner added, "I wish she were here today, with eyes like this in this picture, full of hope and anticipation." The defense team. William Erbecker was the first defense attorney to deliver his closing argument in front of the jury. He tried to paint his client as being insane and therefore unable to appreciate the severity or the criminality of her actions, saying, "I condemn her for being a murderess. That's what I do. But I say she is not responsible because she's not all here." Erbecker then tapped his head to emphasize his reference to her state of mind before saying, "If this woman is sane, put her in the electric chair. She committed acts of degradation that you wouldn't commit on a dog. She has to be crazy, or she wouldn't have permitted that. You'll have to live with your conscience for the rest of your life if you send an insane woman to the electric chair." Holding up an autopsy photograph of Sylvia, Erbecker instructed the jury to look at this exhibit, adding, "Look at the lips on that girl. How sadistic can a person get? The woman is stark mad." Erbecker then referred to the earlier testimony of a psychiatrist who had called into question Gertrude's sanity before concluding his argument. Forrest Bowman had begun his closing argument in the same critical manner as he attacked the decision of the prosecution to seek the death penalty for juveniles, saying, I would like to have an hour of the jury's time to explain why 16-year-olds and 13-year-olds should not be put to death, deliberately avoiding the catalog of atrocities each had inflicted upon Sylvia. Bowman repeatedly emphasized his client's age, stating each was only guilty of assault and battery before seeking a verdict of not guilty for each youth. George Rice began his closing argument by arguing the fact that Paula and the other defendants had been tried together, sidestepping the multiple instances of testimony delivered at trial describing Paula and her mother as the most active and enthusiastic participants in Sylvia's physical abuse. Rice claimed the evidence presented against his client did not equate her to actual guilt of murder. He then ended his closing argument with a plea for the jury to return a verdict of not guilty on a girl who had gone through the indignity of being tried in an open court. James Netter began his closing argument in defense of Richard Hobbs by referring to the loss of Sylvia, stating, "She had a right to live. In my own heart, I cannot remember a girl so much sinned against and abused." He then referred to Hobbs's courage in choosing to testify in his own defense and the savage and relentless cross-examination to which he had been subjected by Leroy New. Netter tried to portray his client as a follower who acted under the control of Gertrude Banaszewski, suggesting that he had not carved part of the obscene insult into Sylvia's abdomen at Gertrude's request. Hobbs could well have been a state's witness as opposed to Stephanie Banaszewski. Netter ended his closing argument by requesting a verdict of not guilty, saying Hobbs was guilty of immaturity and gross lack of judgment, but not of the crime of murder. Convictions. The trial of the five defendants lasted 17 days before the jury retired to debate its verdict. On May 19, 1966, after deliberating for 8 hours, the panel of 8 men and 4 women found Gertrude Banaszewski guilty of first-degree murder, recommending a sentence of life imprisonment. Paula Banaszewski was found guilty of second-degree murder, and Hobbs, Hubbard, and John Banaszewski Jr. were found guilty of manslaughter. When hearing Judge Rabb pronounce the verdicts, Gertrude and her children burst into tears, then attempted to console each other, as Hobbs and Hubbard remained emotionless. On May 25th, Gertrude and Paula Banaszewski were formally sentenced to life imprisonment. The same day, Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banaszewski Jr. each received sentences of 2 to 21 years to be served in the Indiana prison system. Retrials. In September 1970, the Indiana Supreme Court reversed the convictions of Gertrude and Paula Banaszewski on the basis that Judge Rabb had denied repeatedly submitted motions by their defense counsel at their original trial for both a change of venue and separate trials. The pair were retried in 1971. This time, Paula chose to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter rather than face a retrial. She was sentenced between 2 and 20 years for her part in Sylvia's abuse and death. Paula was released from jail in December 1972, even after 2 escape attempts in 1971. Gertrude, however, was again convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Over the course of the following 14 years, Gertrude became known as a model prisoner in the Indiana prison system. She worked at the prison sewing shop and was known as sort of a den mother to the younger female inmates, becoming known to some by the nickname of Mom. By the time of Gertrude's ultimate parole in 1985, she had changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen, a combination of her middle name and maiden name, and described herself as a devout Christian. News of Gertrude's nearing parole hearing created an uproar throughout Indiana. Jenny Likens and other immediate family members vehemently protested against her release. Members of 2 anti-crime groups also traveled to Indiana to oppose Banaszewski's possible parole and to publicly support the Likens family. Members of both groups initiated a sidewalk picket campaign. Over the course of 2 months, these groups collected over 40,000 signatures from residents of Indiana, including signatures obtained from outraged citizens too young to actually remember the case. All signatures gathered demanded that Gertrude remain locked up for the rest of her life. At her parole hearing, Banaszewski said she wished Sylvia's death could be undone, although she underplayed her responsibility for any of her actions, saying, "I'm not sure what role I had in her death, because I was on drugs. I never really knew her. I take full responsibility for whatever happened to Sylvia." Taking Gertrude's good conduct in prison into account, the parole board marginally voted in favor of granting her parole. She was released from prison on December 4, 1985. Following her release from prison in 1985, Gertrude relocated to Iowa. She never accepted full responsibility for being the ultimate architect in Sylvia's prolonged torture and ultimately her death, insisting she was unable to precisely recall any of her actions in the months of Sylvia's increasing abuse and torment at her home. She primarily blamed her actions upon the medication she had been prescribed to treat her asthma. Gertrude lived in obscurity in Laurel, Iowa, until her death due to lung cancer on June 16, 1990, at the age of 61. Reflecting on the news of Gertrude's death and the issues raised regarding her sanity at both of the trials, John Dean, a former reporter for the Indianapolis Star, would say in 2015, "I never thought she was insane. I thought she was a downtrodden, mean woman." Dean also compared the case to William Golding's novel, Lord of the Flies. Although he has said Sylvia's increasing physical and emotional abuse was not a result of children going wild, it was children doing what they were told. Referencing Gertrude's actual motive for tormenting and ultimately murdering Sylvia, attorney Forrest Bowman gave his opinion in 2014. "She had a miserable life. What I think this was ultimately about jealousy." Following her 1972 parole, Paula Banaszewski also assumed a new identity. She worked as an aide to a school counselor for 14 years in an Iowa school district, having changed her name to Paula Pace and concealing the truth regarding her criminal history to the school district when applying for the position. She was fired in 2012 when the school discovered her true identity. Paula reportedly lives in a small town in Iowa. She is married and has two children. The baby daughter she had given birth to while being tried in 1966, and she named after her mother, was later adopted. The murder charges initially filed against Gertrude's second eldest daughter, 15-year-old Stephanie, were dropped after she agreed to turn state's evidence against the other defendants. Although prosecutors did resubmit their case against Stephanie before a grand jury on May 26, 1966, the decision to try and prosecute her in a separate trial never happened. Stephanie assumed a new name and became a school teacher. She later married and has several children. Stephanie Serkstad still lives in Florida to this day. Following the arrest of their mother, the Department of Public Welfare placed Marie, Shirley, and James Banaszewski in the care of separate foster families. The last name of all three children was legally changed to Blake in the 1960s after their father regained their custody. Marie later married and died of natural causes in June 2017. Dennis Lee Wright Jr., the youngest of all the children, was later adopted. His adoptive mother named him Denny Lee White. He died in February 2012. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banaszewski Jr. each served less than 2 years in the Indiana prison system before being granted parole on February 27, 1968. Richard Hobbs died of lung cancer in January 1972 at the age of 21, 4 years after his release. In the years between his release and his death, he is known to have suffered at least one nervous breakdown. Following his 1968 release, Coy Hubbard remained in Indiana and never attempted to change his name. Throughout his adult life, Hubbard was repeatedly jailed for various criminal offenses and on one occasion was charged with the murders of two young men, although he was acquitted of this charge. He died of a heart attack in 2007 at the age of 56. John Banaszewski Jr. lived under the alias John Blake. Several decades after his release, John Banaszewski Jr. issued a statement in which he acknowledged the fact that he and his co-defendants should have been sentenced to a more severe term of punishment, but added that young criminals are not beyond rehabilitation and described how he had become a productive citizen. He died of diabetic-related complications in 2005 at the age of 52. Before his death, however, he readily admitted that he had enjoyed the attention Sylvia's murder brought to him, and also claimed to have only hit Sylvia once. Jenny Likens later married a man named Leonard Reese Wade. The couple had two children together. She died of a heart attack in June 2004 at the age of 54. At the time of her death, Jenny resided in Beech Grove, Indiana. 14 years before her death, Jenny had seen Gertrude's obituary in the newspaper. She clipped it out and mailed it to her mother with a note saying, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I am happy about that." Elizabeth and Lester Likens died in 1988 and 2013, respectively. In the years before her own death, Jenny had repeatedly said no blame could be placed upon either of her parents for placing her and Sylvia in the care of Gertrude and her family, saying all her parents had done was trust Gertrude's promise to actually care for them until their return from the traveling carnival. The Banaszewski house at 3850 East New York Street, in which Sylvia was tortured and murdered, stood vacant for many years after her death and the arrest of her tormentors. The property gradually became dilapidated, and the house itself was torn down on April 23, 2009. The site is now a church parking lot. In June 2001, a 6-foot-tall granite memorial was formally dedicated to Sylvia Likens' life and legacy in Willard Park, Indianapolis. This dedication was attended by several hundred people, including members of the Likens family. The memorial itself is inscribed with the words, "This memorial is a memory of a young child who died a tragic death. As a result, laws changed and awareness increased. This is a commitment to our children that the Indianapolis Police Department is working to make this safe city for our children." That is the story of the death of Sylvia Likens. It's a bit of a rough one, you know. You take a look at your kids and the people that you leave them in care with, and you kind of got to wonder, do you really know the person you're leaving them with? I hope you liked this one. I mean, not liked it as in, like, yay, somebody died, but hope you liked it as informational and factual. Thanks for sticking around. This was the second episode of the Extreme True Crime Show, just kind of a offshoot of the Extreme Horror Replay. We are on the same channel, the same podcast platform as Extreme Horror Replay. But you can find us on Instagram at @XHR_podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Horror Replay. We do have a Facebook page, but it's not very active. But if you got any questions, comments, you know, whatever, drop us a line, leave us a note. So we're doing this by myself. Nancy's still busy with school, so for Extreme True Crime and Extreme Horror Replay, I am Ben, and in the very famous words of Nancy, bye y'all.